I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. Writer Louise Erdrich is one of the most valued novelists of our time, and she is one of the few writers who chronicles Native American life. It's a subject that she's returned to in her latest work, The Roundhouse. She joins us today from Minnesota Public Radio, where she's on a book tour, and you can catch her next Monday when she'll be at Porter Square Bookstore in Cambridge. Louise Erdrich, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Callie. I'm happy to sort of be there. I'm here, but yes. I'm there. Yes.
In spirit, for certainly.
I certainly am. My voice is with you.
All right. Spirit is something that you write a lot about, actually, in most of all of your novels, which base themselves in Native American life and culture. Talk a little bit about that first, so we have a context about this new book, The Roundhouse.
I think that the in context here, we are talking about two things. First, it's a political novel. It's a relationship novel. The relationship is between a boy and his mother. His mother is attacked. Her spirit is violated. And in part of the book, he says, we would do anything to bring her spirit back into her body. I mean, this violation occurs, and it's a tremendous disruption of all that he's loved in his family life. And he's just turned 13, and his father is a judge. Can his father fix it? Who can fix this?
You've said that the book is really about focusing on answering the question, "What is justice?" What do you mean by that?
When I started thinking about this book years ago, I really didn't know how to approach it because the fact is it's very difficult to obtain justice for women who are the victims of sexual violence on reservations. The reasons for that I can't go into in depth because it's a tangle of laws that prevent an easy fix. And there is a bill in Congress right now that would provide some relief in this situation. So it's a very timely book. But as I thought about it, I knew that I couldn't talk about it the way I'm talking to you right now. I had to tell a story. So I had to tell the story. I didn't know who was going to come forward and tell it with me, but it turned out to be Joe, a 13-year-old boy.
And that's what's so fascinating about how you move to tell this story through a 13-year-old boy, because obviously you're not a 13-year-old boy, and that would seem to be.
I am. I found out I really am, and I really loved writing this book and having boys as my friends and getting to ride my bike again. You know, I guess I was a tomboy. I had brothers. My daughters have brought this menagerie of 13-year-old boys into my life, and I have so enjoyed listening in and sort of being part of their world.
So this was not uncomfortable for you to inhabit 13-year-old Joe's body and spirit and character as you were writing from his perspective this powerful story?
I have to say, not in the least, and I really miss it now. Mm. I feel like it's over. I just want to go back. I so enjoyed, enjoyed in a way, because he's faced with a tremendous burden that no 13-year-old should be, have to face. His choice when justice is denied to his family is vengeance. You know, that's his choice, and that's the choice of so many people who are denied justice. And he knows he's the only person who can bring this about. Is he going to do it? You know, is he going to take vengeance? This is the heart of the story. And so when I say I enjoyed it, I also really, I felt with him through the whole book.
I would have thought that it would have been a little harder writing him, as you've said, you feel like you inhabited the 13-year-old spirit. Then I was curious about why this character wasn't a 13-year-old girl. I mean, you could have had similar experiences, and in some ways, the connection with the mother would have been perhaps on an emotional level even deeper.
That's really an interesting question, but I didn't really have that choice. You know, when your character comes to you and you get this person talk, I really get this, my character is talking to me, and this was a boy, and that's who he was. I'd never written a relationship like this before, so I didn't know if I could do it, but this voice kept on returning to me. And it also I wanted to explore how his world would be affected after all. You know, I didn't know, and so I had to go on with the book the way it was.
I'm speaking with Louise Erdrich. Her new novel, the 14th novel that she's written, is called The Roundhouse. It is set in Ojibwe territory.
Ojibwe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, territory.
Yep.
Set in a Native American community. And the core of the novel, and this is not giving anything away, I'm being very careful not to give away all that happens in the book, is that his mother, 13-year-old Joe's mother, is raped. And there are many layers to this because, as people will learn, folks who know nothing about laws governing sovereignty and tribal lands, that it matters where the rape took place and it matters who did the rape. Mm-hmm. I should reference an NPR series that Laura Sullivan did in 2007 that opened a lot of people's eyes, Louise Erdrich, to this issue.
Yes.
And one of the statistics that she made clear in her piece is that 1 in 3 Native American women will be raped in her lifetime, which is an incredible number. And her very powerful series, which is available archivally on NPR, really details some of the issues that you play out in a novelistic, fictionalized way through the story of Geraldine, who is raped and who is Joe's mother.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, 88% of these rapes are committed by non-Native men, and most go unprosecuted. So it's a tremendous epidemic of violence, and the tangle of laws I described have a partial fix in the works if the House Resolution 4970 can be approved. You know, there's something being done at long last. You know, this is set in 1988. And it's 2012, and the partial fix is only being considered now.
Hmm.
So it's been a long, long road to this, even this partial form of justice for women.
Now, what makes novels speak to everybody, no matter what their experience may be, is the universality, of course, of the emotional happenings, the relationships between the people. And in this case, we have 13-year-old Joe, we have his mother, Geraldine, mm-hmm. and we have the father, Basil. And they're quite close-knit family before this happens. And as is often detailed by those who are rape experts, that loss of trust and that vulnerability that comes when a violent act like this happens to a woman is really quite profound. And I thought in the way that you describe the brokenness of their relationship after what has happened to her is so powerful. And I wondered if you would read a bit the scene that I'm referring to is on page 42. It starts at the bottom and goes on from there.
Absolutely. And I think you're right. The reason I wanted to have this take place in the context of a family is because so often, you know, I think it's especially in this current conversation that has been going on about rape, it's considered something that a woman alone sort of suffers. But it's not. It's something that the entire family has to come to terms with. Now, where would you like me to start, Kelly?
It's toward the bottom, walking through the kitchen door.
Right. I took my bike out and wheeled it around the back. My father entered before me. Walking through the kitchen door, I heard a splintering crash and then a keen, low, anguished cry. My mother was backed up to the sink, trembling, breathing heavily. My father was standing a few feet before her with his hands out, vainly groping in air the shape of her, as if to hold her without holding her. Between them on the floor lay a smashed and oozing casserole. I looked at my parents and understood exactly what had happened. My father had come in. Surely Mom had heard the car, and hadn't the dog Pearl barked? His footsteps, too, were heavy. He always made noise and was a somewhat clumsy man. I'd noticed that since the attack in the last week, he'd also shouted something silly when returning, like, "I'm home," but maybe he'd forgotten. Maybe he'd been too quiet this time. Maybe he'd gone into the kitchen just as he always used to, and then he'd put his arms around my mother as she stood with her back turned. In our old life, she would have kept working at the stove or sink while he peered over her shoulder and talked to her. They'd stand there together in a little tableau of homecoming. Eventually, he'd call me in to help him set the table. He'd change his clothes quickly while she and I put the finishing touches on the meal, and then we would sit down together. We were not churchgoers. This was our ritual, our breaking bread. And it all began with that trusting moment where my father walked up behind my mother, and she smiled at his approach without turning. But now, they stood staring at each other helplessly over the broken dish. It was the kind of moment, I see now, that could have gone several ways. She could have laughed, she could have cried. She could have reached for him. Or he could have got down on his knees and pretended to have the heart attack that later killed him. She would have been jolted from her shock, helped him. We would have cleared up the mess, made sandwiches, and things would have gone on. If we'd sat down together that night, I do believe things would have gone on. But now my mother flushed darkly, and an almost imperceptible shudder coursed over her. She took a gasping breath and put her hand to her wounded face. Then she stepped over the mess on the floor and walked carefully away. I wanted her to shout, cry out, throw something. Anything would have been better than the frozen suspension of feeling in which she mounted the stairs. She was wearing a plain blue dress that night. No stockings. A pair of black Minnetonka moccasins. As she walked up each riser, she looked straight ahead, and her hand was firm on the banister. Her steps were soundless. She seemed to float. My father and I had followed her to the doorway, and I think as we watched her, we both had the sense that she was ascending to a place of utter loneliness from which she might never be retrieved.
That's my guest novelist, Louise Erdrich. She's reading from her 14th novel, The Roundhouse. That's a really powerful scene, and I thought what made it so powerful for me was the quietness of it, and also you really got a sense of just, you know, how disruptive emotionally something like that can happen, as you said, to the entire family. Mm-hmm. So it was really very, very powerful in its quietness. Now, Louise Erdrich, for people who don't know your work, I should let them know that you're a finalist, other work of yours, for the Pulitzer Prize, your piece, The Plague of Doves. You've also received the National Book Critics Circle Award for your debut novel, Love Medicine, and you were a finalist for the National Book Award. So, and a lot of your work, as we've said, really settles around Native American life. You yourself are Native American?
I am a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, right?
And
in Boston right now, you know, you have
yes.
this very interesting, you know, I don't look it. So I'm, you know, I'm with that percentage of people who have sort of thrown their photographs into the pile and said, look, you know, not everyone looks the way you think Scott Brown people are supposed to look. We look all sorts of different ways. You know, we're of varying degrees and mixtures of tribes and non-native, and but we're all culturally who we are. And I'm really proud, very proud of who I am.
And I should say that one of the threads of your book, it's a smaller thread, has to do with the fact that Geraldine Joe's mother, the 13-year-old's mother, work is really about verifying who is
exactly.
in the tribe. Yes, yes.
And it is, yeah, isn't that interesting?
It is interesting.
And, and she, you know, and he says, you know, this is very interesting because Native Americans, unlike other groups in the country, really have to parse their blood quantum for the U.S. government. So that as a tribal enrollment specialist, she has to do that. You know, she can't just accept someone who has some idea that they might be Native American. She has to have all the birth certificates, the documents, all of the all of this evidence. So she does this, and he says, on one hand, you know, this is necessary for things to go on. On the other hand, being Native or Indian, like sex, love, or having a baby, is none of the government's business. We know one another. We know it by who we are. So,
well,
it is quite pertinent to what you're saying.
Yes.
To what you're saying. What's going on in the
In the Massachusetts Senate race here with Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown.
It's very interesting. Yeah.
You were writing this book when you were suffering a health crisis, and I wonder, did it help you, or was it harder to write this kind of really emotional story while you yourself were sick?
Yeah, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and fortunately it was early stage. It was about halfway through this book. And I hesitate, that's all I'm going to really say about it, because the book isn't about me. I'll say that my family helped me find solace, the time to have solace in writing. My daughter Palace came home and cooked. My God, she cooks better than I do. And she came home. You know, my family was around me, really supporting me. So I had the I had the muscle to get into the book, and I had the time, and I needed it for solace. I needed the writing.
Actually, I was thinking that it would be harder for me to write when I was, you know, so that it actually in this case seemed to help you in some way to be able to put this
down. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I felt driven, but I always feel pretty driven. I'm sort of obsessive, so I don't know.
I think something that'll become immediately apparent to people who read your work who may not have read it before are all of the cultural references to Native American life. And if you know, wherever you fall down in your image, if you know nothing, let's just start there. If you know nothing about Native American life, modern Native American life, you may start from, well, I don't know. How do they live? What's going on the reservation? I don't think you have a good sense of how culturally bifurcated it is, because, you know, you're on the reservation, but you're an American. You live in this, you know, so there's lots of stuff going on. I was taken with your references to commodity foods and how people use that, and then what happens when they shop in different places outside of the community. All
really?
Of these things are just, you know, woven in. No, I mean, I was aware of it before, but I'm just saying that the fact that it's woven in the way that it is, like a tapestry.
That's interesting,
I think will resonate with people as they read it.
Oh, I'm really glad. You know, I'm glad about that because, well, the fact is that Native American people are really dual citizens of their own tribal nations and the American citizens as well, but didn't receive American citizenship until after World War I. You know, it was quite relatively recent. So,
and part of this cultural mix in this book, The Roundhouse, you talk about ceremonies, spiritual connections that are very much a part of being Native American. And then that's also this strain of Catholicism. So that was an interesting mix because one of the characters is a priest, and the young Joe.
He's the gun-toting priest.
Yeah, he was a very interesting priest, as an Iraq veteran. That whole mix that everybody had, several people had in their lives of Catholicism and also a Native American spiritual life was very interesting.
Well, this is particular to many reservations, and in the beginning, different denominations sort of picked and chose where they wanted to go, and the American government was behind that. But Catholics made the first inroads as Jesuits, so they were the first contact people, and many tribes have Catholicism as a basis, sometimes as syncretism between Catholicism and traditional ways, which my own family has developed, and so it's a very intertwined on this particular reservation and on many.
And then you have the extra layer of a 13-year-old boy and his buddies who are irreverent in their just being 13 years old. So I thought what really grabbed me are those scenes, and I'm going to ask you to read one on page 16, where there is a sacred ceremony going on, a sacred Native American ceremony, and yet the young men are a kind of make a little fun of it, you know, a little bit.
Is it page 16?
You know what? It may not be page 16. I think I have the wrong page here. Let me find it. It's the one when they're doing the fire. And we should mention that the roundhouse refers, while you're finding it, because I don't know why it says 16, that's not the right page, that the roundhouse is a space that is has a sacred connection in the community. So people know what that refers to.
and a lot of a lot is made of the circularity of the ceremony, and
it's actually 36.
Yes, I have it now.
Okay, all right.
And so this sweat lodge, of course, is around. It's a set of poles that have been bent over, and tarps are placed over it, and then there's a pit in the middle, and hot stones are brought in. So I'm going to read.
Toward the bottom down here is a wheat, also throw it back, because it's a very sacred ceremony. But here's Joe, 13 years old, with his buddies, 13-year-old, and they know it's a sacred ceremony, but at the same time, they're boys.
That's their job. Their job is to keep the fire going, hand the sacred pipes and the medicine, bring the rocks to the door on long-handled shovels, close and open the flaps. We'd also throw tobacco onto the fire when someone in the lodge yelled for it to mark some special prayer or request. On crisp nights, it was a good job. We'd sit talking around that fire, staying warm. Sometimes we'd secretly roast a hot dog or a marshmallow on a stick, even though the fire was sacred, and one time Randall had caught us. He claimed we'd taken the sacredness out of the fire with our hot dogs. Happy looked at him and said, "How sacred can your fire be if we sucked out its holiness with just our puny wieners?" I couldn't stop laughing. Randall threw up his hands and walked off. It was too hot to roast anything now. Besides, we knew we'd eat hugely at the end. Food was our pay. It was usually a pleasant enough job. That night, however, instead of cooling off, it grew muggy. There was no breeze. Whining clouds of mosquitoes swarmed us. Their attacks made us sit closer to the fire in order to take advantage of the smoke, which only made us sweat enticingly. They just kept sucking on us through the salty, smoky layers of off. Randall's friends, who all belonged to a powwow drum or danced like Randall, showed up laughing. You want me to keep reading through that?
That gives me a good sense. I think it gives people a good sense of, I just love the fact that here were the boys throwing hot dogs and marshmallows on the sacred fire.
I know. They're
my God, this is like really irreverent.
Well, you know, they're hungry.
And they're 13, so they have kind
of a jaundiced eye
toward the whole thing.
Randall is kind of pompous in his, what happens, you know, it becomes more and more absurd. And so anyway, that's for the reader to find out.
That's what I loved about it, though. You have this nice mix of expressing the life of a 13-year-old in this very serious situation. But his friends, the Greek chorus of 13-year-olds, are really right at 13. I mean, you know, you're reading along and you realize, you know, yep, that's 13.
Yeah, it's 13. And, you know, it's true, too, that even the most serious ceremonies, somebody will do something to crack everybody up. I don't know why, but that's kind of the Ojibwe. Well, the real way to say it is Anishinaabe, but that is always what happens. Somebody is funny. Everybody is funny.
One of the things I thought was interesting in the way that, and again, I'm being careful about not to give away the, you know, many twists and turns in the book, but Joe, who is at a particular point in his life, his young life, he's not even really a teenager, there are many times as the book continues and the story unfolds that you allow us, and through him, to see where he'll be later. He references, you know, for example, what his life will be later when he's older. And I wondered why you did that. Was that to relieve those of us? Because the way you tell the story, there's rising tension as we're trying to figure out what's going on, what happened, what really happened, and the story is revealed. And I wondered if that was to just give us a break, the reader.
Well, I think it's because I wanted to be able to have a more eloquent voice looking back and sometimes fall back into the 13-year-old looking at things and how they were, but also be able to gather it all up at certain moments, just a few moments, to gather it all up for the reader, you know. And I couldn't do that if I simply had the 13-year-old boy going through everything right then. But also, I got into these parts of the book where I just felt like I was 13 and I was just writing writing these scenes and these conversations. So that's how it went.
So it's also interesting to me that Basil, his dad, is a judge. So when you think about justice and who would, mete out justice or think about justice in writ large, you would have thought that the father would have been the one who might determine how justice must be exacted. But yet, he was not.
But yet, he finds it impossible. And he knows it as soon as he realizes that his wife doesn't know exactly where the crime took place. So he knows that there is a problem right away. And you even know there's a problem from the first minute when she's interviewed and there are, you know, three different sets of police or, you know, law enforcement entities interviewing her. Not just one, but three. And that's in case it took place on one type of land or the next. You know, so that confusion is, I hope, part of the book in a way that becomes tangible for people. I have no background as a legal scholar in any way, so I had to make it understandable for myself. So that's what I'm hoping will happen for the reader.
Have you, is this the first time that you have determined, really it's a story, as we would say in this business, ripped from the headlines, so to speak. Even if these are headlines that are under the radar for a lot of people, this story is that. I know you say your characters speak to you. You don't quite know. This is what novelists tell me all the time. And since I've never written a novel, I can't imagine how you get there. But what struck you as wanting to do that this time, this go around?
Right. I knew about the situation for quite some time. It's been ongoing, and the problem was I couldn't think how to tell it, and I couldn't think how to tell it without becoming polemical and, you know, really giving a long, I don't want to fall into the diatribe trap. So I had to wait until some character came to me and wanted to tell the story, and it was Joe. So, you know, you really don't have the control over who's going to tell it, but I knew I had to have the relationship and the story come first, and that had to be the most important part. And the rest I had to try and figure out how to fit in so that it would be understandable because it is a complex situation.
What do you want people to take away from the book? I mean, other than just, of course, enjoyment, as I think most writers want that. But beyond
that. Yeah, I do want that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is the fact that I wrote it as a suspense novel, and I enjoy writing suspense into the books. So as much for myself as for a reader, so that I can find out what's going to happen next and, you know, want to get up and get to the writing again. But the larger implications are all in bold type at the end of the book. So that's up to the reader. If you want to get involved in the political process that's going on, that's great. But, of course, I do write because I am addicted to and love writing, and I love that readers are reading books. And in this time of sort of perilous publishing and reading and writing, I'm so thankful that there are so many people out there who love the tangible feel of a book and want to read it with the devotion that a book, I think all books, I'm a bookstore owner, so I'm kind of a bookophile, yeah.
Me too.
So I'm just touching my book here and saying, yes, you know, you're a book. I think there's something very important about the tangible, physical connection between a person and a book. And it's interesting that this is, you know, being called into question right now. So I treasure it.
I think when a story, and, you know, at heart, that's what draws all of we bibliophiles as well, when a story really grabs you, for me, it means that the relationships that are articulated there are both universal, but there's something else about them that stands out. And I am completely struck by the layered relationships in this book. Both the immediate family of Joe and Geraldine and Basil and their family and what's going on. Joe and his group of friends, Cappy and Angus and Zach. Then Joe and his connection to his older relatives, who also have a relationship to the larger community as sort of patriarchs of the Native American community. And then, of course, then you have the other layer of the legal relationships. But the interweaving of all of those is for me, the power of this story. And, you know, just when you think you figured it out and you haven't, something else reveals itself in that. And that is what I give you all credit for being able to pull that off.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's really something because you're just drawn into it so many ways. You can enter into the story and stay there in so many different directions. I guess that's what I would say.
No, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you, Kelly.
And when you determined, this is what I don't understand about novelists. So the voices are coming to you, and you're putting that all together, putting these relationships all together. I don't know how they inform you of their relationships to each other. I know what they say about themselves, I think, from having interviewed a number of novelists. But
how do they
guide you to building the kind of relationships that are so fundamental in this book, The Roundhouse? And again, my guest is Louise Erdrich, and her book is The Roundhouse.
In this 13-year-old world, you know, that he has, where he has a relationship with his parents, of course there's going to be a fraught moment or two where he wants to throw off their discipline and their even presence entirely. So he's caught in this tremendous sympathy for his mother and his enormous irritation with her. And some of that's from life. I mean, you know, I'm a mother. So I can tell that I get to this point in my daughter's lives. And fortunately, I have great daughters. But they fight this. Like, I really, you know, I got to get away from her. And all kids feel that. They need to distance themselves. And this is happening to him. You know, he has to distance himself at the same time as he's being drawn inexorably closer because of his mother's suffering. So it's a very, as you said, layered and confusing set of emotions for him.
I know you've written stories before. This is a novel, of course. I wonder if we'd ever see Joe again in another. Just wondering what may happen to him.
Right.
There.
Well, I didn't know, really, that he would show up and that my judge from The Plague of Doves and his wife would be blessed with a son. It just happened wonderfully. It worked very well with the previous book. So I have no idea.
All right. Well, I'm going to hope that Joe shows up again. I'd like to learn.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to see him again as an adult.
thank you. That's a great compliment, and I appreciate that and appreciate talking to you.
Well, I've enjoyed speaking with you, too. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with novelist Louise Erdrich about her new book, The Roundhouse, and you can catch her next Monday at 7 o'clock at the Porter Square Bookstore in Cambridge. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Whether you stream it, TiVo it, or do it couch potato style to catch prime time, changes are coming to the way you watch TV. What does the future of television look like? We'll talk with TV blogger Ryan McGee. I'm Callie Crossley. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH.